Welcome to The Grill Room. On the menu this week, all the latest news, views, and opinions from the world of professional golf. Your maitre d's are Bob Bubka and Alex Maselli, two friends who rarely agree on anything. You can count on them to give you both sides of the story, whether you want it or not. So come on in, have a seat, and remember, anything that comes from the Grill Room is definitely on our tab. The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses. And remember, keep your applause to a mild clap, all right? After all, we're talking golf here.
Safe to say, the 2015 season underway. Welcome to the Grow Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses, powered by Golf Week. Let me waste no time to get the resident factologist in for the Grow Room. He's the one, he's the only, Alex Maselli. How we doing, my man?
Well, I think you did take a little too long to get me in.
A lot of listeners feel that way, but there are some that would say I got you in way too fast.
Well, I mean, that's a possibility, I guess. I don't know who they would be. But I'm doing well. I mean, it's hard to believe that the season is now rocking and rolling. They're going to be moving from the West Coast to the East Coast. And before you know it, we're going to be in Augusta.
Well, it's certainly going to be a lot of hype. You bring up a good point there. With Rory McIlroy, obviously, needing the Masters for the fourth leg of his Grand Slam, the pre-tournament hype is going to be unbelievable, I say.
Well, I mean, especially, too, if he somehow, some way wins the Masters, then we would be going into, you know, territory that is very unfamiliar to most of us, with needing just to win the U.S. Open to get the Grand Slam in a year, not a calendar year, just like Tiger did.
Yeah, he'd be the only other golfer ever to do that.
Right, so I guess what do? Do we call it when we're hyping into the U.S. Open going to Tacoma, Washington, do we call it the Tiger Slam? Or what if Rory does it? Then is it the Rory Slam? Is it, you know, what is it then?
I don't know. You know, when you think about records, I'm glad you brought that up. Watching some football yesterday and saw that Peyton Manning, 509 touchdowns in the NFL. I mean, that to me is astounding. I mean, if you do 10 a year, you know, that's what, 160, you know, that you would end up with, and now you got to do that for, you know, a lot, 160 a year, you know, that's a lot.
Are you asking me or you're telling me?
No, I'm asking you. I always ask. I never tell Alex Maselli anything.
No, I would agree with you. That is a lot, considering it took Brett Favre, what, like 80 more games or something like that to get to that?
Yeah, and I think it, you know, there's so many arguments about who the best quarterback ever to play the game. And, you know, you certainly got to put Peyton Manning's name up there. By the way, Jim Brown record, I guess you know, too, was broken by a running back from Dallas, McMurray. I don't want to turn this into a football show, but he's, you know, gained 100 yards in seven consecutive games. The record was held by Jim Brown, and many argue that Jim Brown, the greatest player ever to play in the NFL. I don't know how you sit on that one.
Well, I mean, here's the problem. I didn't see Jim Brown play. You're only relying on what other people wrote or whatever people said or that saw him play. And it's very similar to the issues we have now with Ben Hogan or Jack Nicklaus, or if you want to go all the way back to Bobby Jones. You know, none of us saw him play. We read what people wrote about him. We see some video, depending on who it is. I saw Jack play as a senior, but not as a competing tour player. You saw him a little as well. But, I mean, it's pretty impossible to be able to make those judgment calls. I think what you can certainly say is when you get to a player that's in an era and you look at him versus everyone else that's in that era, I think that in itself is enough to determine how good that person was or wasn't.
All right, let's get back to golf. That's what the Grow Room's all about. As you mentioned, Mr. Maselli, two events down, only 45 to go. Let's talk about the Shriners Hospital for Children Open. Ben Martin hits that big jackpot in Las Vegas. Another first-time winner on the PGA Tour. He was the 54-hole leader for the first time in his career. Ends up winning by two over Kevin Streelman. But what a close to his round. I think there was a birdie and an eagle at the end.
Well, he birdied. He made a big putt on at the end to birdie to win by two. But he always seemed to be a bit in control, making good putts down the stretch. It was one of those. I think he's one of those guys that had the most one putts during the week or something like that. On those greens, that to me, as you saw guys stroking their putts, seemed very, 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 very fast. Look, Ben Martin has played well over stretches since he's been on the PGA Tour. Didn't make the cut, missed the cut last week in Silverado, and then turns around and comes back and shows up in Las Vegas. To me, that's the most astonishing part about golf. You know, you see a guy and on Friday afternoon packing up his stuff, getting ready to go, not very happy with anything, going to the next stop, shows up at the next stop, and all of a sudden he's the 54-hole leader and goes on to win the tournament. I don't understand that. I understand that you can make incremental, changes in your performance, but to make drastic changes in a week is something that I never can understand.
Well, it's a good tease. Later on, we're going to have a special guest joining us on the Grill Room. He talks about the mental side of the game a lot. And Alex, it's pretty obvious that player that was disgruntled, throwing his clubs in the trunk on a Friday afternoon, and then shows up, as you alluded to, the following weekend and plays lights out, certainly nothing about him physically probably changed. So it was all mental, and we're going to find out a lot more about that later on. By the way, Ben Martin winning in Las Vegas brings back a dear memory when I had the opportunity to play with Dean Martin in Las Vegas. So quite a thrill to have done that. Thanks, Ben, for winning. You brought up a good memory for me. So now we have two tied for the FedEx Cup lead after just two events. Obviously, both winners are both in their 20s. Sungmoon Bae winning the previous week. Ben Martin, Alex, 56 career PGA Tour starts. I wonder, where that number falls. Is that about average for first-time winners? Is that low for first-time winners? Is that high for first-time winners?
I would think that's relatively low. I mean, what you're looking at is basically around two seasons or so. That's all you're looking at. If you look at the guys that win for the first time, I don't think there's a lot that can get it done in two seasons. There are some, obviously, but most of these guys. I mean, look at Jimmy Walker. How long was he out there?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I probably agree with you that, winning for the first time in under 60 starts probably falls into the unusual category. Ben Martin, he comes from Greenwood, South Carolina, not far from the Masters. He'll be teeing it up there now. He said he's been going to the Masters since he was a little boy, first time for Ben Crenshaw's win in 1997. So it's going to be a big deal for Ben Martin to go down to the Masters next year. And as we alluded to, certainly going to be a lot of hype around it with Rory McIlroy with an opportunity to complete his Grand Slam. So good news for Ben Martin.
No, I mean, obviously, winning on the PGA Tour is always a plus, and there's so many things involved with you not having to worry about your card, getting in the players, and getting yourself into situations, getting in invitationals and things like that, things that really make a difference that, you can really, I don't say work on your game, because some people that do that end up not keeping their card, but just really takes a lot of pressure off, allows you to set your own schedule. Sure, Ben Martin's got a pretty good idea where he likes to play and where he doesn't like to play. And all those are a positive for some guy that just won a tournament.
Well, besides the winners, Alex, there were some good stories there. I guess no better than Jarrett Lyle, a two-time battler against the disease of cancer. He roughly made one-fifth of the amount he needs to retain his cord. Tied for 42nd this week. But Jarrett Lyle, he's the kind of guy, and you know him, Alex. I've met him on several occasions. You just want to root for him.
Well, I mean, obviously anyone that has an issue like this, and it's not the first time, it's the second time for him to battle back. I mean, it's painful and difficult to do. And, as much as you're pulling or I'm pulling or Robert Allenby is pulling. You know, pulling is only so much. I mean, he has to actually accomplish it and do it. And that's the hardest part. And that he can do that, that he seems to be able to play well enough to go ahead and do that. And I'm sure he's going to probably go off to Australia now and then come back. I mean, these are all huge things, things that that not many people can do. I mean, it requires not only the mental aspects, but also requires the physical aspects. I mean, you look at Gerald Lyle now versus what he looked like a couple years ago, and he's certainly not even close to the same person physically, and yet he's finding a way to get it done. And that's, I think that's the most impressive part of it.
Yeah, and he's a relatively new father. Good luck from the grow room to Jarrett Lyle. Sam Saunders, tied for 23. He just seems to be plugging along. And for that one listener that might not be aware of Sam Saunders, his grandfather, none other than Arnold Palmer, Sam's had it tough because no matter what he does, you know, within 10 seconds of anybody announcing Sam Saunders, they come out with the grandson of Arnold Palmer. And quite frankly, he's out there trying to make it on his own.
Well, that's true and not true so much. I mean, I think Sam Saunders has it difficult right now, partly because he created a situation on his own. He didn't really focus when he went to Wake Forest, had opportunities that he didn't take full advantage of. But in spending some time with him last year at Bay, or this year actually at Bay Hill, where he had an opportunity to play pretty well and actually had a pretty good finish, you know, it was quite interesting. I was really impressed by him. He made a lot of decisions that he thought were best for him, that his family may not have agreed with. He goes around in a van or a motorhome with his wife, and I think he's got two kids. And they drive around and go to event, at least when he was on the web.com tour last year and getting those incremental starts on the PGA Tour. So that's what he's still doing, I'm pretty sure. And, you know, he's taking a completely different approach to how to do it. He's not relying on anyone else. He's certainly not relying. He spends time with his grandfather, talks to Arnold, I know, and talking to Arnold. But the bottom line is he's doing it on his own, and I think he's going to be better off for that in the end. I think now he's got a much better understanding of what it requires and what it takes to be a professional athlete and a professional golfer, and where he might have tried to lean on the laurels of Arnold Palmer and being his grandson and so forth and so on. I think Sam Saunders is certainly his own person. And it's going to be interesting to see how he does, but I think he's playing well enough and feels good enough about his game that I could see him easily retaining his card, which would be quite an accomplishment because there's not very many of the players that former parents were such good golfers that can that end up keeping their card. There's very few, in fact.
No, you're right about that. And speaking of keeping the card, I think maybe he's going to do a lot more than that. The name Tony Finau. He's a rookie, played two events. What did he do? Tied for 12th and finished 7th last week. He's now 10th in FedEx Cup rankings. Certainly somebody I have my eye on as a rookie to watch.
Well, you know, what's interesting about him, Bob, is he's going along, you know, 2 or 3 under par on Saturday, third round in Vegas, and then he inexplicably makes a 7. That should have never happened. I mean, he was like 150 yards from the green in 2, I think it was. It was a par 5 maybe or whatever it was. But the point was is that, I mean, he really botched it up. He had nothing left. I think it was even less than that. I bet he had a wedge in his hand, and he made the cardinal mistake of going over the green and being down in a little bowl. And next thing you know, you look up, and he makes a 7. And so you take that away from him, and his T7 ends up being a lot better than that. So I think he's got the game. He feels comfortable with his game. He's a long hitter. He's going to have to learn how to play on this tour. But that being said, it looks like he's got a good feel for it now. And if he can minimize the mistake like he made on Saturday, you know, he's looking at a top 5. And you don't need too many of those put together to all of a sudden have your card. And you know, he's a guy that will probably play all 5 of the events on this early swing. And then you know, you can look up and after. You know, if he makes puts another 2 or 3 weeks together like he's put together, you know, all he's looking at is gravy on top of everything else he's got because he's got his card already.
Yeah, $340,000 his first start, and I think you were being a little modest, on the PGA Tour. I think you were being a little modest in your description that he's a little bit long. Some of the shots that I've seen Finau hit, Alex, I mean, he's monster long, and if he can learn to harness that distance with, you know, fairly fair amount of accuracy, you know, he's going to be good out there.
Well, I don't think there's any question. And you know, that's one of the things that you find that guys that come from the Web.com Tour to the PGA Tour, they can just about hit it anywhere on the Web.com Tour. It's not an issue. On the PGA Tour, it is an issue. You just can't hit it anywhere. And I think Finau has got a pretty good handle on that. You know, I'm just saying in the case that I saw wedging his hand over the green, you just can't make those mistakes.
Well, what else happened around the world of golf? We'll find out after this break. Remember, you're listening to The Grow Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses, powered by Golf Week.
You're listening to The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.
The outside light and weather change. Your sunglasses should too. Transitions Adaptive Sunglass Lenses change their level of darkness depending on the light outside to enhance your vision during golf and other outdoor activities. Partnered with Callaway, Oakley, and Nike, Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses increase contrast, improve distance and depth perception, and reduce distracting glare so you can see the game you love even better. Visit transitions.com/sunwear to learn more and buy a pair today.
The light changes, the lens changes. It's as simple as that. Nike and Transitions Optical have collaborated to create a new lens technology that is both responsive to light and specifically engineered to sport performance. Nike Max Transitions Golf Tint Sunglasses will help improve contour recognition on the golf course and increase ball pop. You'll literally see your game in a whole new light. Buy a pair today at Nike.com.
The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.
Around the World of Golf continues now on The Grill Room. Let's start, Alex, with the European Tour, Hong Kong Open.
Well, Bobby, you know, there are players that show up at these events that that you may have heard the name before, but you really don't know much about them because they jump from tour to tour. Scott Hend is one of those guys, jumping from tour to tour. I remember covering him when he was trying to qualify in Columbus for the U.S. Open. He was such a character back then. He qualified. He was a little disappointed because that meant that he had to cancel all his reservations to go to play in Italy and turn around and bring his entire family to the U.S. Open. So it was kind of like I was listening to him say this. I almost like, well, why did you even try to qualify, for goodness sakes? But Scott Hend didn't have to qualify in Hong Kong. One. In a playoff off over Filipino and Angelo, is it Quay? Angelo Quay?
You got it.
And it's his first win on the European Tour, which means it opens up a lot of doors for him in that tour. And, you know, it's one of these deals where here's 41 years old, Australian guy, and he's been playing all over the place. Now all of a sudden he wins on the European Tour, and it just opens doors for him at 41, doors that he probably didn't expect to be opened.
Well, he's a sharp dresser. I remember when he showed up at that U.S. Open, it was at Congressional. I think Judith Coleman, one of the good people in the golf family, was serving as his caddy. And I remember he had these tremendous slacks on. And I said, Scott, boy, I love those slacks. He said, well, I'll give you the name of my tailor. And his tailor, believe it or not, was in Hong Kong. So apparently Scott Hend has, you know, some knowledge of Hong Kong. I bet he went down after that victory, picked up a few more pair. I made the inquiry, and they were not in the Bob Bupka price range, but they were in the Alex Maselli price range. And I meant to give you that information. We'll be able to do that in the future. Right now, let's give a listen to what Scott Hend had to say after that big victory.
This golf course doesn't really play into my wheelhouse. It doesn't play to my strengths. And I had to be very mentally tough and play the course mentally right. And Tony and I, we managed to do it this week, and we sort of unlocked the puzzle. Now I can celebrate. Now I'm happy. Now it's awesome.
Awesome. You're right. Now it's time for a Grill Room look at the Volvo World Match Play at the London Golf Club. I think you played there, didn't you, Alex?
No, never been there.
Wow.
Never been there. But, you know, Mikko Ilonen from Finland is a guy that you may know, has played well in the past, won on the European Tour. He defeats Henrik Stenson in the final. I think it was 2-1, but I can't remember correctly. But, you know, here's another example of a lot of really good European players that we might see, you know, possibly at a Ryder Cup in 16. Ilonen's a little older. He's not a young guy. He's in his 30s. But, you know, he's one of those guys that plays two or three events, then goes back to Helsinki, turns around. Actually, he doesn't live in Helsinki when I think about it. I think
why is he going there then?
What's that?
Why
well, he's
got
to fly
there?
In there. There's only the one place to fly into, Helsinki, for goodness sake. But really good guy, and certainly been a good player most of his career, but now he's starting to win events, which obviously is reaps benefits for him. Let's hear what he has to say about his win.
I played a lot stronger this afternoon than I did this morning, and for some reason I felt comfortable. You know, you would have thought maybe get nervous against world number five, but I've played so much golf with Henrik over the years, so I feel like we were playing just a friendly match.
Now, since Volvo is pulling its sponsorship of this event, does it go away, or is there another sponsor in the wings, Alex?
You know, the European Tour has some issues, Bob, trying to find some sponsors, not only for this event, for some others as well. I don't think it goes away. It's an IMG event. I think they'll work hard to try to find someone. I think the marketplace is such that they should be able to find someone. It's interesting that Volvo, I think, sponsors three events on the European Tour. They're going to drop two of the three. I think the only one they're going to keep is going to be the one in China, I believe. But, you know, let's be honest. Volvo is not a huge car manufacturer. Their market share has gone down, so it's understandable for them to make that switch. It's just harder to find people for the European Tour than it is for the U.S. Tour. But even the U.S. Tour has struggled. I mean, it took us a long time to find a sponsor for match play that's going to be in April now at Harding Park. So that being said, I think it's going to stay. It's just going to take some time to find somebody.
Yeah, Volvo was really high in the United States when their primary focus was just on safety of the automobile. I mean, everybody would say, you know, oh, the safest car drive is a Volvo. And then they went into styling and other performance issues. And as you said, even though I hate to agree with you, they have lost a lot of their market share. And that's obviously why they're pulling back on some of their advertising they've been doing on the European Tour.
All right, Bobby, while we're in the overseas mode, let's mention the Korean LPGA Tour member, Kyu Young Baek, I'm going to say, made her first appearance in the LPGA Tour event this week. And she won the KEB Hana Bank Championship, played in Incheon, Republic of Korea. And she made it a memorable one by winning, birding the par 5 18th for a sudden-death playoff defeat to follow over Brittany Lincecum. Now, I'm going to tell you, Incheon is exactly the same place that I believe we're going for the President's Cup as well, right?
It is, exactly. And every time I hear that, you know, some exchange of fire between North and South Korea, this President's Cup could be one of the most exciting events we ever covered in the history of golf.
Oh, the Incheon Peninsula is too far away from the 38th parallel. I'm not worried about that.
All right. You're not worried. I'm twice as worried.
All right. And let's move on to the Champions Tour. Jay Haas, the timeless one, records his first win since 2012 in the Greater Hickory Kia Classic at Rock Barn. I think it's his third win in Rock Barn. And he's the 18th player to win over the age of 60. I'll tell you one thing. He almost let it slip away on Saturday near the end in the third round and then had complete control over it coming down the stretch in the fourth round.
Well, he gave a lot of inspiration to a lot of our listeners out there that have the problem that they even hate to hear the word, but it was clearly evident Jay Haas was suffering from the yips on a couple of those putts, and when they put the camera on that putter, it does not come back smoothly He's going to have to work on that. He overcame it with great ball striking and whatnot. And ironically enough, that is his 18th player, as you said, to win at age 60 or over. And it's his 18th win on the Champions Tour. He's just had a little dry spell since 2012. Joe Durant, last week's winner, Kurt Triplett, both tied for second. Both those guys playing some great golf.
Yeah, Triplett is playing very good golf, and really it was just maybe some poor ball striking down the stretch on 18 that made the difference. He would have had the eagle 18 anyways, and Durant would have had as well. But, no, I think Durant birdied, actually. So, no, eagle he would have made it. But boy, bottom line is that Kirk Triplett now playing very well, Jay Haas playing well, Joe Durant playing well, and another guy that's playing pretty well is Paul Goidos, who's only played out there, I think, 8 events on the Champions Tour and is already in the top 30 and is almost assured of being in the Charles Schwab Cup for this year.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And nobody, I have never seen anybody as happy to turn 50 as Paul Goidos. He knew what was waiting for him. He knew how good his golf game was, and he is now taking full advantage. We're going to take advantage and take a look inside Golf Week when we return. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at TGR Golf and on Facebook at The Grill Room Golf Show. This is The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses, the equipment for a visual advantage empowered by Golf Week, where you go inside the ropes.
The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.
Want to improve your golf game? Improve your vision. Callaway and Transitions Optical have created Callaway Neox Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses, designed to enhance visual performance while playing golf. They automatically adjust color and darkness, sharpen depth perception, and offer superior clarity. You'll have more accurate distance vision and be better able to see the terrain and contours all day, regardless of weather and light conditions. Buy Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses at CallawayGolf.com or learn where to get a pair in your prescription at transitions.com/sunwear/Neox.
Sight is one of our most valued senses. Many cherished memories and important life lessons are acquired through sight. Through the Transitions Healthy Sight for Life Fund, we're reaching out in communities around the world to help people understand and protect their healthy sight. Think about what you'd miss seeing if you lost your eyesight tomorrow, and take steps to protect your vision today. See more at HealthySightForLife.org.
The outside light and weather change. Your sunglasses should too. Transitions Adaptive Sunglass Lenses change their level of darkness depending on the light outside to enhance your vision during golf and other outdoor activities. Partnered with Callaway, Oakley, and Nike, Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses increase contrast, improve distance and depth perception, and reduce distracting glare so you can see the game you love even better. Visit transitions.com/sunwear to learn more and buy a pair today.
Welcome back to The Grill Room. Your table's ready. Now here's Bob Bubka and Alex Maselli.
Hey, thanks for listening to The Grill Room. Remember, we are presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses, powered by Golf Week. Alex Maselli, one of the many fine writers for that publication. Our hot topic this week is Inside Golf Week. Ryder Cup fallout just doesn't seem to go away. You wrote a great story in Golf Week firmly saying Paul Azinger should be the next captain.
Well, I don't see why he shouldn't be the next captain. Let's put it this way, Bob. If you were trying to minimize the amount of fallout that would come about, the only way you could do that is to go ahead and pick Paul Azinger as the captain. And there's many different reasons why, outside of the fact that he was the last guy to win in the United States, the last guy to win since 1993 or 1999 when we had Ben Crenshaw. But the bottom line is the only one that the players seem to have any respect for, that they feel they could go into battle, if I could use that term, in a Ryder Cup with him and expect to win. And I don't see any other options or any other opportunities out there. I mean, if you said, okay, Paul Azinger's not in the mix, who's next? It'd be very hard to pick one guy, much less two or three, to take a selection from.
You know the situation, Alex, and I've been giving this some thought. Yes, we definitely need a Ryder Cup fix, even though, you know, there's no guarantee whatever the prescription for the cure is that it's going to be successful. It's going to come down to, you know, who plays the best golf when we get to Hazeltine. But I get this feeling, Alex, that this situation is being put into the microwave, and we're trying to get something fast out of it. And I think it would work better if we were putting it in a slow cooker. And you know, let's not rush into you know, the task force and whatever ideas they're going to have to come up with. You know, let's just let things settle down, because you know there's so many sidelights coming out. I know you had an opportunity with Nicklaus. I mean, Jack Nicklaus came out and he said he was on Tom Watson's side.
Well, not only was he on Tom Watson's side in support of him, saying it's the players have to play better, but he was also completely against any kind of task force. And, you know, I don't think people realize when Paul Azener took the job for the 08 captaincy, he didn't say, when they said, would you want to be captain, he didn't just say yes. He said, I'll be captain, but here's what I want. And he outlined a lot of different things, including changing the whole point structure and changing when they would pick and how many he would pick. That was all on him. That wasn't a PGA of America initiative. And so, you know, the things that we are talking about now are very similar to what Paul tried to do before. You know, I don't know why Watson went from 4-3 in regards to captain's picks. I don't know why we didn't do some other changes. But when Azener sits down with the PGA of America in November, he's going to outline an entire plan, and a plan that they haven't really ever thought about. And so I think that's another reason why you take a look at Paul Azener and say, well, this is someone that is, you know, forward-thinking, that has done this in the past, that has incorporated his own ideas, and that they've worked. And, you know, if we would have stayed with those, I think I made an argument, if we was, it wasn't so much that we were falling all the wayside. I mean, after 2008, in 2010, Corey Pavin was dealt a very difficult hand in regards to what he had to do, and was one session that made the difference. I mean, we were leading. We were leading after the first day, basically, in Wales. And if we didn't have to play those six events in a row, six events, there was two foursomes, I think, and four four-ball in one day, if we didn't have to do that, where we had to expose some guys, probably, is what it ended up being, maybe we're leading going into the singles. And in fact, what happened was is we lost. We only won a half a point out of six. They won 5.5 points, and we were only down two going into singles. Just think if that wasn't the case. Just think if we didn't have to do that change of schedule or that change of format. If Corey Pavin and the PGA of America would have said, you know what, I'm not in any rush to get out of here. We'll take our time. We're going to do it the way we agreed to do it before. Then maybe all of a sudden we don't lose in Wales. And then you take it, and you take it one step further, and you look at Davis Love, who's four up. He's four up going into singles. I mean, again, these are systems that in some way, shape, or form were part of iterations of what happened in 08. You know, we were okay in 10 and 12. We didn't win, but we were okay. We were playing fine. This whole idea that we needed to blow everything up in 14 and name Tom Watson and do this and do that, those didn't work. That was going back to the old ways. That wasn't staying with the new ways. And so Paul Azener is the new way. So we have to decide if we want to go the new way or we want to go back to the old way. And quite honestly, I don't think there's any question which way we should be going.
Yeah, but the problem actually for Azinger and the new way and the pods, he goes to Hazeltine as the captain. The other team plays better. He loses. Then all of a sudden, the mystique and the shine, you know, that 08 victory is tarnished somewhat.
Well, personally, I don't agree with that. What I do agree with, though, is that, sure, he's putting his legacy on the line. I don't think there's any question about that. But let's be honest. If Paul Azinger, A, finds a way to win, or B, loses, but we lose with a system that we believe will be something that we can hang on to and hold on to and use over the next five or six Ryder Cups, it'll be a victory. It'll be a plus, and it'll be a plus. Maybe people won't say it'll be a plus in 2016, but maybe looking back in 2024, after we've won two or three more Ryder Cups, then all of a sudden people say, you know what, this all stems back to what we did in 16 and what Paul Azener did in 16. So I think there's a lot more positive than negative because quite honestly, you know, these guys are willing to do something for Paul Azenier that they probably weren't willing to do for Tom Watson. I don't care who what the team is. And I think that's the whole point. Putting the guys in the best possible light, put them in the best position possible to win the Ryder Cup. And I think Paul Azenier can do that. And I think Davis Love did that. And I think Corey Pavin, to his own credit, did that as well. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. What we need to do is we need to get a system in place. And there's only one guy I know of that can put a system in place, and that's Paul Azenier.
Well, I'd be a little dismayed at what you said, that players are willing to do stuff for Azenier that they weren't willing to do for Tom Watson. I mean, if I thought for 1 minute that was true, then I would have a campaign never to let any one of those 12 players ever play the Ryder Cup again.
You know, Bob, it's not a conscious thing. And clearly, Tom Watson didn't endear himself to the players. And I just think that it was just one of those situations where it just didn't work well. And it's not against, there's nothing against Tom Watson. I mean, he could have won, and he still didn't endear himself to the players, and the argument would have been, see, this is what we needed. We needed a firmer or a harder hand with these guys. Bottom line is I think he just wasn't one of those situations where he's beloved by his players. And I think you need that connection to some extent. And he didn't have that connection, that's all.
Well, not a good season for former Ryder Cup captains. Ian Poulter, in his new book, he calls out Sir Nick Faldo, and he was very unhappy with the Sergio insult he fired off on national television during the Ryder Cup, actually calling Sergio useless to the Ryder Cup team. And now more and more stuff is coming about that, you know, other players were very unhappy with Nick Faldo, but they kept it to themselves. That story's not over with.
No, and it wasn't going to be. It's just what happened was that kind of got foreshadowed. That was just a foreshadow to what happened with Mickelson and Watson, so that got pushed on the back burner, as well as the fact that the Europeans won. So, you know, if the Europeans had lost, that might have gotten a little more play earlier on in the process. But, you know, what's interesting is Poulter had to physically obviously stop the printing or tell him not to print yet or do whatever he had to do to make that change in his book, because his book is just coming out, and you got to figure he needed some lead time. So he had to somehow find a way to get that added into the back of the book. That just shows you how upset not only Poulter was, but I'm sure a lot of the European Tour players were. And he's right. All those guys kept their mouth shut, weren't happy with Faldo, but didn't say anything because they believe that that's not the way to approach it. And so they didn't say anything. Now, once Faldo opened up the can of worms, I think you're going to see a lot more guys come out and not only defend Sergio Garcia, but take a shot at Faldo, who quite honestly deserves it for coming out and saying what he did.
Well, shouldn't that situation serve as a little bit of warning to the PGA of America and also to Paul Azenier? And I like Paul. I admit I'm nowhere near as close to him as you are. But if indeed Nick Faldo was a lousy captain, then Paul Azenier's victory, you know, has to be put into perspective.
Well, do you put... A lot of people say that Mark James' captaincy in 99 was not a good job. Do you say that?
Well, people said that he shouldn't have, you know, rested people until Sunday.
He had a four-point lead going into Sunday, for goodness sake.
Yeah, I know.
He needed his guys to show up. I mean, is it on Mark James or was it Ben Crenshaw did something? Is Ben Crenshaw as good a captain as we want to make him out to be, because he sat there and wiggled his finger on Saturday night and said, I got a good feeling about this?
I'm not talking about 99. I'm just saying
in general. I mean, so Crenshaw gets a lot of credit for what happened in 99. Should he get that credit?
I was talking about 08, and it's obvious. Let me finish, Alex. It's obvious that as soon as I mention anything that's not, you know, Paul Azenier, red, white, and blue, you get your feathers ruffled.
All right, here's what I'll say. Paul Azenier is the captain of the U.S. team against Nick Faldo. He doesn't control what Nick Faldo does. He has no input on what Nick Faldo does. He can only control one thing. He can only control the U.S. team. He won. Nick Faldo lost. At the end of the day, these Ryder Cups come down to one thing: who won and who lost. So am I going to give him props for winning? Yes. Now, if it was, if he won against a guy that can't spell cat, I don't care. Because at the end of the day, we're now down to one thing and one thing only, is who wins and who loses. If Paul Azinger loses to Nick Faldo, then Paul Azinger is going to be the same GOAT as many of our Ryder Cup captains have been. You know, that's just how it is. Do I think Jose Maria Olazabal did such a great job at Medina? No. I thought Davis Love did a great job at Medina, made one or two small mistakes, which ended up ultimately maybe costing us the Ryder Cup. In turn, do I think that Jose Maria Olazabal is this great captain just because he won? No. But the bottom line is he won.
Well, that argument certainly has to be made for Tom Lehman in Dublin, where we were in the pouring rain most of the time. You know, Tom Lehman, I thought, did everything right from A to Z and comes out on the losing end.
And had a horrible team. I mean, come on, look at some of those guys. Vaughn Taylor, J.J. Henry, Brett Wetterich. I mean, J.J. Henry's the only guy that's got his card.
Well, there you go. I
agree with you. I'm just saying, I agree with you. You know, Ben Curtis, who's got his card, lost his card, got his card, lost his card. I'm just saying, you know, that's true. I don't disagree. A lot of people think that Lehman did a great job. A lot of people think Kite didn't do a horrible job against Ballesteros, except for a couple of things. We almost won that Ryder Cup. I mean, you know, in 97. Look, the bottom line to this is it doesn't matter who's on the other side. It just matters what the result is now. It doesn't matter. Mark James should never be the GOAT. I hear the Europeans talk about him being the GOAT all the time. The bottom line is these guys needed to just play, for God's sake. They had a 4-point lead going into Sunday. They just needed to play. I don't care who he put at the top end, the bottom end, or anything else. I mean, he's got 12 guys. They just got to play, and they didn't.
Well, nobody,
you know, and he has no control over that.
Nobody wants the Americans to win any more than I do in 2016. But maybe, just maybe, when we take a step back, we should be focusing on getting 12 better players rather than getting a better captain.
Well, but I mean, this year was kind of an odd year, Bob, a very odd year. Three of our guys that would have been on the team, no question, couldn't play because of injuries or whatever else. Then we had two guys that certainly should have been on the team, but the system, which has been in place generally for a long, long time, finally showed some flaw. First time in 39 Ryder Cups that the selection process didn't work the way it should have worked, basically. So, yeah, Billy Horschel and Chris Kirk should have probably been on this team. But the bottom line is that it's only the first time that's ever really happened, so it's something that you address. You can't foresee that so early. You know, I get back to this, though. If Captain Tom Watson had a pick, an extra pick, if he would have had four picks instead of three picks, maybe he could have picked Billy Horschel or Chris Kirk. And I will also say that, you know, in listening to some of the comments that Webb Simpson has made, he clearly shouldn't have been a guy that Tom Watson should have picked. And if Watson wouldn't have been so, I don't know, free with his picks, so, you know, crazy in the way he decided to make those picks, maybe he could have had two better players on the team.
Well, we'll never know. You know, we had a contest last week. You're going to get a kick out of this, Alex. The question was, how would you select the next Ryder Cup captain? We had several entries that really delved into the pros and cons of the system, offering some great ideas, and we appreciate the time and thought that they put into their response. In fact, with their permission, we may submit these great answers to the PGA of America for consideration. However, this week, the winner is Ron McFarlane, who submitted some ideas that were so humorous that we had to award an Ion Loop bracelet to him. So, Ron, Janice will be in touch. And here's what we got, Alex, from Ron McFarlane. Before giving my solution, I think people should quit piling on Tom Watson and look at stats. If my recollection serves me correctly, Watson is the last captain to win on foreign soil. Did he poorly captain the players then? If Spieth doesn't choke with a 4-up lead and Mahan doesn't blow a 3-up lead, we may not be having this discussion. Here is how the U.S. wins the Ryder Cup. 1. Have a committee. which includes three-star players with below-average records in Ryder Cup and matches, and a player who has never won a match. Make Phil Mickelson the playing captain, so he will be able to play every match and make the winning pairings and improve on his 11-17-6 record. Name Richard Lee, president of the North American Ping Pong Association, as co-captain. 4. Allow a designated substitute, which can be used to replace a player during the round if the original player can't handle the pressure. 5. Win more matches. Signed, Ron McFarlane, research analyst for golf. And these are the words of our contest winner, and not the opinion of the Grill Room. Some pretty funny lines in there, Alex.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about this. There can be a lot of funny lines. There's a lot of things going on with this, and it'll be interesting to see what happens as we proceed. But you know, it's frustrating. It continues to be frustrating.
Hey, in Focus on Vision, brought to you by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses, equipment for a visual advantage. Dr. Keith Smithson, a sports vision specialist, explains the importance and the advantage of wearing Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses while playing golf. And that's who we're going to hear from when we return.
You're listening to The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.
The light changes, the lens changes. It's as simple as that. Nike and Transitions Optical have collaborated to create a new lens technology that is both responsive to light and specifically engineered to sport performance. Nike Max Transitions Golf Tint Sunglasses will help improve contour recognition on the golf course and increase ball pop. You'll literally see your game in a whole new light. Buy a pair today at Nike.com.
The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.
All right, we're back in the Grill Room, and I want to welcome in Dr. Keith Smithson, a sports vision specialist. He'll explain the advantages of wearing Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses while playing golf.
In a sport like golf, which is obviously visually demanding and has a lot of other visually demanding important qualities, you know, some of the other things that we look at are things like depth perception and the way that we actually pinpoint targets, you know, looking at the pin location on the green and being able to truly and accurately assess where that is. You know, we all have range finders and things this way that help us with that, but can we read the sloping properly? Are we going to get the backspin on the ball right? You know, we're looking at depth perception and muscular components and, you know, some of the other things with contrast enhancement and being able to see and read shadowing on greens. And, yeah, I mean, to me, that's one of the most challenging factors in the sport of golf. So it's very difficult sometimes to have someone walk out with a pair of glasses, let's say their sunglasses, and they're a solid standard tint that's the same consistently across the board, meaning that it doesn't change. So the problem with the round of golf over that wide variable lighting condition is that if the lens itself doesn't change, then we're stuck with looking through a consistent tint when that may not be the right thing to do. So the nice thing about transition technology is transition lenses actually darken and lighten based on UV light exposure. So as we're outside playing a round of golf, if the sun and clouds, you know, do vary through that round, if the clouds are coming over, if it's sort of an overcast day and we're getting a lot of shadowing and things that way, then what happens is the lens itself is actually a lighter shade of tint, so it's closer to being clear. As the UV comes back out, as the lens is actually activated from that UV lighting, there's photochromic crystals in the lens that actually do activate. There's now even a polarized state that lens can go into. So there's a lot of things that lens does to actually vary based on the lighting conditions. So when we're under those brightest conditions, the lens is at its darkest and doing the most sun filtration. If the bright light is now at its least, now we have that lens at a much more gradual or much more gradient sort of tint. So it's a wonderful product, and it works great for the game of golf.
I want to thank Dr. Smithson for explaining the advantages of Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses while playing golf. Next up, Bob had a chance to find out the inside story on a book by Dr. Michael Lardon. He wrote the book about mastering golf's mental game, Your Ultimate Guide to Better On-Course Performance and Lower Scores, forwarded by Phil Mickelson, and that's next in the Grill Room.
You're listening to the Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.
It's his first visit to the Grill Room, but hopefully there'll be many more. His name is Dr. Michael Lardon. You came up with a new book that has everybody buzzing about it, Doctor, called Mastering Golf's Mental Game. It is the ultimate guide to better on-course performance and lower scores, and there's not anybody that listens to the Grill Room that plays this wacky game that certainly wouldn't want to lower their scores.
Yeah, and, you know, really, if you think of tour pros and average players alike, people that love golf and play golf, they have lots of information about technical aspects of the game, swing and the physical training even nowadays. But no one or very few players, you know, tour players with exception, really have any mental strategy. So, you know, what happens when I'm in the club championship and the 18th hole, I need a par and there's water on the left, you know, what do I do? And to say, oh, don't hit it in the water, or don't think about the water, that normally doesn't work. So we give the reader and the golfer strategies that we use with tour players that have really worked out to be very successful. And I have found it really been very, very helpful for everyone who participates in it.
We're speaking with Dr. Michael Lardon, who has a great book out called Mastering Golf's Mental Game. And before we go, Doctor, I'd love your answer to this question, because it's been bantered about for years, ever since I've even covered the game, and I'm sure a long time before that. What percentage do you put on golf being mental versus physical?
Well, I think as you become more elite in golf, it becomes more between the ears. And I think that's true in many, many sports. At the higher level, we see, you know, the tour players, they all have shot, you know, 60 or 61 or tremendous scores. Now, why do certain players, Tiger and Phil, I mean, why can they do it on Sundays? That's really the trick, and that's something that's between the ears, and that's been my life's work, so I'm really happy to share it with the general public.
All right, speaking of that, Doctor, how can our listeners get a hold of your book?
Well, I'm really happy that it's number two in golf right now on Amazon behind Ben Hogan, so that makes me feel good. But you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, pretty much can get it anywhere, so it shouldn't be hard to find.
All right, let me give that name out once again before I say thank you. Mastering Golf's Mental Game by Dr. Michael Lardon, our special guest here in the Grill Room. Thank you for your time, and hopefully we're going to make a few golfers happy after they read your book.
Well, great. Thanks, Bob. I really appreciate the opportunity to come speak with you and your listeners.
I want to thank Dr. Lardon for some great insight there. Now let's play a little news and notes music there, Janice Self, and let's go right to it. First one is Tiger Woods. What a surprise. Tiger and his foundation. Bobby, recently lost a lawsuit Tiger did in regards to memorabilia signing that he's appealing. Now all of a sudden his foundation has some issues going all the way back to Alan Stanford. You know, it never ends with this Alan Stanford thing. Poor David Toms, and then you got Henrik Stenson. There's probably some other guys involved. But
well, Vijay Singh took quite a bath, too, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it just never ends. The guy's in jail. Let's get it over with. But there's this trustee, I think he is, in Houston, Texas, that continues to go after every nickel and dime. I've never seen anybody so tenacious in regards to trying to find this money. But they're going after every dime that somehow, some way could be connected to Alan Stanford and his Ponzi scheme. And poor the Tiger Woods Foundation is now the next recipient of this trustee, and they're going after money from them as well. It just never ends, does it?
Well, let me ask you this, Alex. Champions Tour now has a new president, Greg McLaughlin, who, you know, was head of the Tiger Woods Foundation. Is there any connection between those two items in news and notes?
No, just that they seem to happen at the same time. McLaughlin came to the tour, I want to say a couple of months ago, and it was quite interesting because when he did go, all of us were wondering what he was going to do, and obviously the tour had a pretty good idea what he was going to do, as Mike Stevens, the current head of the Champions Tour, was obviously leaving. So we don't know what Mike Stevens is going to be doing. He's leaving the PGA Tour, and Greg McLaughlin's going to slip right in. I thought Stevens did a great job, and I'm assuming McLaughlin will do a good job as well.
Well, we've known him for a long time. We want to wish him the best of luck. I concur, much to my dismay, because I have to agree with Mr. Maselli, but I think Greg McLaughlin will do a great job. What's next on the schedule? That's coming on the Grill Room after we take a brief timeout.
You're listening to The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.
The outside light and weather change. Your sunglasses should too. Transitions Adaptive Sunglass Lenses change their level of darkness depending on the light outside to enhance your vision during golf and other outdoor activities. Partnered with Callaway, Oakley, and Nike, Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses increase contrast, improve distance and depth perception, and reduce distracting glare so you can see the game you love even better. Visit transitions.com/sunwear to learn more and buy a pair today.
The light changes, the lens changes. It's as simple as that. Nike and Transitions Optical have collaborated to create a new lens technology that is both responsive to light and specifically engineered to sport performance. Nike Max Transitions Golf Tint Sunglasses will help improve contour recognition on the golf course and increase ball pop. You'll literally see your game in a whole new light. Buy a pair today at Nike.com.
The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.
Delivering on the promise, what's next on the schedule? We start off on the LPGA Tour. Alex, they're over in Asia.
They are. The Blue Bay LPGA event. Never heard, I don't even know anything about this, Bob, except for the playing for $2 million, and there's a lot of the Americans still staying over there. It's, I think, a six-week swing, and we'll see what happens.
And, of course, we mentioned at the top of the show the PGA Tour now underway for the 2014-2015 season. Champions Tour, they're going to be playing their last full field event of the season. Last chance for players to qualify for the Charles Schwab Championship. It's going to be the AT&T Championship at TPC San Antonio. Kenny Perry defending.
I think this might be his first week back, Bob, since he played in the PGA Championship at Valhalla. He was going to take an extended leave of absence, knowing that he was feeling he couldn't catch Bernhard Langer in the Schwab Cup standings. So he decided to take a long time off. So he's going to be defending. We'll see what happens. Bernhard Langer certainly is the guy that everybody's looking at for the possibility of, you know, winning that Schwab Cup. So we'll see what happens there. That Charles Schwab Championship will be the week after. It's the top 30 on the money list. European Tour is the IPS Handa, sponsors the Perth International for the third year. Jeff Ogilvie, Jason Duffner, Charles Schwartz will headline the field along with rising star Victor Dubuisson. I think that's Duffner's first return since the PGA Championship as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm happy to see him playing down there. Apparently that's a shoulder injury that he disclosed to us at the PGA Championship has been healed. Great to have Jason Duffner back. Of course, for the European Tour, I should say, last chance to make the field for the final series in the Race to Dubai. Top 60 on the official money list, make it into the final series field, and then eligible to share in the Race to Dubai bonus pool if they finish in the top 15 at the end of the World Tour Championship in Dubai, the last event of the final season on the PGA Tour. I know you're going to be there, Mr. Maselli, at the McGladrey Classic. Lovely place. I'd love to see your accommodations. They have to be overlooking the ocean there in South Carolina.
No, I wouldn't say they're overlooking the ocean, but it's nice down here. I've already got here. It's warm. It's in the 70s, so it is pretty nice. Chris Kirk, defending champion, along with Webb Simpson, Matt Kuchar, Bill Haas, Zach Johnson, Harris English, and Jonathan Bird are going to be in the field. Patrick Harrington back on the comeback trail, starting to play better and better. Tony Finau and Sam Saunders are playing as well. So it's a pretty good field. Davis Love III is going to be here as well as the host and as a player. I'm looking forward to spending some time with these guys because I haven't seen a lot of them since the Tour Championship and some, obviously, since the Ryder Cup.
You're listening to The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.
Well, Bobby, that's it. Another week in the books. You're listening to The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.
equipment for a visual advantage, and powered by Golf Week, where you get the inside story every week.
And a big thank you to our partners, Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses and the Golf Week. For Janice Self, Alex Maselli, and myself, Bob Bubka, thank you for being part of our Grill Room family. Please follow us on Twitter at TGR Golf and on Facebook at the Grill Room Golf Show. And you can hear us by going to golfweek.com.
Thanks for spending some time in the Grill Room. No need to leave a tip. Just come back again next week. The Grill Room, presented by Transitions Adaptive Sunglasses.